Some years ago, Newsweek called Alan Greenspan the world's second most powerful man, and at the time the customary grovelling had him as the most influential person in the US next to the president, or indeed more important to the president than the president. Whether this is true or not, the chairman of the United States Federal Reserve Board, America's central bank, enjoys something of a cult status, a man who can affect the world's markets with a nod or a shake of his rather lugubrious head. And there's a photo of him there, and it is lugubrious. Greenspan's now had the job of the chairman of the Fed for 19 years. It's a bit like Hoover. Perhaps he's got files on everybody. He's been appointed or reappointed by 1, 2, 3, 4 presidents, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and most recently by W. Now, while Wall Street, the US media and the government have tended to beatify Greenspan, he does have his critics, and we've got two of them now. In the Sydney studio is Peter Harcher, international and political editor for the Sydney Morning Herald, a title he's achieved at a remarkably young age. Peter is also a visiting fellow at Sydney's Lowy Institute, one of the few think tanks which isn't overwhelmingly right-wing, and he spent 3 years as Washington bureau chief and associate editor of The Fin, Australia's Financial Review, and he's just published a new book called Bubble Man, Alan Greenspan and the Missing $7 Trillion. But, of course, he's not talking about the sort of bubble some people live in. He's talking about the sort of bubble that human beings sometimes create. And we've discussed a great many of them over the years on the program, because they go back quite a while. On the blower from Chicago, we have Paul Kasriel, who's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist at Northern Trust in Chicago. That's one of the world's largest private banking, asset management and asset servicing firms, and if I had lots of money, I'd be asking Paul to look after it. He's a former officer in the Economic Research Department of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, and he's the co-author with Keith Schapp of 7 Indicators That Move Markets. Did the market move for you, darling? Welcome, both of these gentlemen, to Late Night Live. Peter, would you clarify the definition of a bubble, if indeed it has a definition that we can grasp?
Well, it's there are two answers. The sort of textbook answer is a bubble is formed in a market when the price of the assets gets out of line with fundamentals. But the better answer is probably something more like the elusive definition of beauty. It's hard to frame it exactly, but you know it when you see one. And we saw,
and you might see it in the South Seas or in in Tulip Mania, for example.
Exactly. And the great man Alan Greenspan himself has said it's impossible to tell one until it's already burst.
Well, that's convenient, isn't it?
Exactly.
Let's look at the US stock market bubble, which began in 96 and burst. Boy, did it burst in 2000. You've described it as a great American madness. Millions have swept up in it, of course, and Greenspan as the charismatic leader of a manic cult. But there are a lot of contributors to what went wrong, weren't there? Who were they?
Well, there were a lot. There was the you had to bring the masses along. You had a frenzied investor class, which gradually spread right throughout the system. You started with your rusted on stock market investors, but as the years progressed and the market seemed only to be able to go up and never down, the expectation became entrenched that it would never end. So you had 55% of American high school students in the end were buying stocks. You had more investment clubs in America than you had movie theaters. It really became a mass phenomenon, and by the end of it, Americans had more money in stocks than they had in their own houses.
It infected, did it not, many of the more conservative sort of financial advisors and managers and companies as well. They all seemed to lose their heads a bit.
Well, that's right, and quite a number of them stood against the tide, but after this went on for 5-6 years, a number of them just gave up the ghost. I mean, George Soros, the famous billionaire speculator, was one. He held out against it. He said, no, this is a bubble. It's going to burst. After, I think, 4 or 5 years, he said, all right, I give up. I'll join in and I'll speculate on it like everyone else. So there was the investor class. There was the Wall Street marketing machine. There was the echo chamber for the Wall Street marketing machine known as the media. And critically, of course, there's the guy who supplies the money that any bubble needs to keep growing, to keep money cheap and flowing easily, and that is our hero, Alan Greenspan.
Why are you so nasty about this poor little bloke? Why do you point the finger at him? He looks a nice enough fellow. He looks sad and grumpy.
He looks like he nurses a secret sadness, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Well, what was his role?
Well, you know, I'm prepared to give credit where it's due, and he did establish himself as a folk hero for good reason, and that is that when he first took the job, he'd only been in the job 2-3 months, and the Americans had the 1987 Black Monday October stock market crunch. Greenspan responded magnificently, pumped huge amounts of liquidity into the market, brought interest rates down. The economy was protected from recession. And he did that with several shocks.
So he did a Canute, he turned that tide, did he?
Yeah, he did. He turned, and likewise, after September 11, he did the same thing again. Likewise, when there was a concern about Y2K bug everybody was terrified about, of course it proved to be nothing. But in each of these cases, Greenspan did, you know, it's really very simple what a central bank does. He's only got one weapon, one tool. He's got this giant lever.
Lever, as Keating used to describe it.
Yeah. And they've only got one for all the jargon and the meetings and the high science. He's got one dirty great lever, which pushes interest rates up or down. And Greenspan used it, and he used it forcefully each time.
On those occasions, well, why didn't he at least slow down or manage the madness that we're about to discuss with Paul in Chicago? Why did he suddenly behave in this, what seems like, totally rational way?
Well, he was gearing up to do something about it. He could see that it was way out of line. He could see that it was carrying the economy up to great heights. It was going to burst and the economy would be dashed to the ground. They'd be in recession. Everyone would lose their money. He saw it unfolding exactly as it was going to. And we know that because we have the minutes of the Fed's, you know, secret meetings. They're published in full 5 years later. And he even went so far as to begin to warn about it. You'll remember he gave a famous speech where he said the markets were entering a period of irrational exuberance. But then something funny happened. After he gave that speech, markets around the world took a tumble, but then Greenspan stopped on that agenda. He stopped warning about the bubble, he stopped shaping up to do something about it, and he switched and went over to the other side and became a cheerleader. Now, really, the question you're asking is, why did he do that? What changed?
Mm.
And the short answer is this. He played the politics, not the economics.
Let's bring Paul in now, sitting over there in Chicago. Paul, you're a bit tougher on Greenspan than Peter. You seem to be arguing that he enabled the stock market bubble, that he was one of its progenitors.
Well, a bubble requires the financial oxygen to inflate, and that oxygen comes from a central bank. Central bankers are legal counterfeiters.
I'm sorry, run that past me again.
Well, that may be an oxymoron, but central bankers essentially create credit and money out of thin air, much like a counterfeiter does. Creates money out of, they use paper, but central bankers are more efficient. They don't even need the paper. They do it with computers. But if you study the history of asset price bubbles, you see that they are accompanied by cheap credit. And that's exactly what Alan Greenspan provided in the late 90s. Only in 1999 did he start to raise interest rates, and he was forced to at that point because inflation of in prices of goods and services started to move up. We'd already had inflation. That was in asset prices. But the prices of goods and services started moving up in 1999, and in mid-1999, he then started raising interest rates and cutting back on this oxygen that had been inflating the bubble.
I'm not sure whether it was oxygen. It seemed more like laughing gas.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, because I watched people around me, otherwise sane, reasonable people, becoming as euphoric and giggly as some get after they've been to the dentist.
Exactly.
I mean, it was the oddest thing, wasn't it? And and the same with the tulips. You know, if you go back through history, it needs a sort of a strange contagion to rage through a community. It almost needs an epidemiologist to examine it rather than an economist.
But you're right. But it is the central bank that creates that laughing gas. And then when the NASDAQ bubble burst in 2000, early in 2001, Greenspan set about creating more laughing gas, and this time for another bubble, and this one is now in the housing market.
Well, you seem to be describing a serial blower of bubbles.
That's exactly what Mr. Greenspan is.
Now, Paul, except as for a time during the two world wars, I understand that the Fed has been independent of government. Given what Peter's just said about playing the politics rather than the economics, is that the case now?
Well, you know, I'm an economist. I'm not a political scientist, so I don't know that I can answer that question. But I have observed some things. I observed that when President Clinton came into office and wanted to raise taxes, Alan Greenspan, who I don't believe was ever a big fan of tax increases, more a fan of cuts in government spending, endorsed the Clinton tax increase. And then as a budget surplus developed late in Clinton's administration, and there were talks of cutting taxes to eliminate this evil surplus, Alan Greenspan warned no, first cut expenditures and then see if you can cut taxes.
He sounds a very amiable and amenable sort of a fellow. Now, young Peter Hatcher here, what are we looking at here? What sort of a human being do we know him to be? Is he someone who says one thing privately, another publicly? Is he still blindingly ambitious? Does he want to be everyone's friend? What's going on?
Well, perhaps the most revealing single remark I've seen about him, having studied him for years, read everything ever written about him, met him and talked to him extensively, perhaps the most interesting thing I've seen anybody say was a remark of his former wife, who said, "You know, I've never seen Alan angry." Now, how many, divorced first wives could say that about the man they, married? I mean,
astonishing,
isn't it?
It suggests the beatification process is appropriate.
It suggests that we're talking about a man who is very, very detached. Another on the theme of detachment, another interesting observation is that, during the 1990s, the two big socioeconomic phenomena that defined the U.S. were, one, the internet, and two, the stock market boom. Alan Greenspan, one, to this day doesn't use the internet, doesn't use email, and two, never bought stocks. So he was sort of an enabler, as you say, and as Paul says, of this phenomenon, and yet he stood aloof from that too. So we're talking about a very interesting, very detached, very analytical guy. Now, one of your questions was, is he a sort of guy who says something and does something else? Well, we know from the published record, there's a documentary trail on this now. We know that he was doing exactly that on this bubble. We know that privately he was saying to the Treasury Secretary, Bob Rubin, for 5 years, "I'm really worried about this. This is terrible. This is going to be a disaster." Inside the Fed, he was saying, "This is a big problem. We have to do something about it." Yet in public, he was giving speeches saying that this is the greatest example in the history of humankind of an example of free markets and free people, knowing that the whole thing was just a disaster waiting to end badly.
Paul, what sort of quid pro quo occurs between the president and the chairman if and when the chairman is, shall we say, receptive to presidential or administration influence?
Well, one is reappointment.
That's a goodie.
The chairman is reappointed every 4 years. As I was talking earlier, Greenspan had an epiphany in early 2001 when Bush took office. And Bush, of course, was ran on a platform of cutting taxes. And Greenspan came up with a rather interesting argument as to why taxes needed to be cut in 2001, because the budget surplus that existed then was forecast to continue for years and years in the future. And so he said, we have no alternative but to cut taxes now. What else will we do with the money that will be...
So he doesn't need a drawer full of intimate files about presidents like J. Edgar has. He's just amiable.
Well, Greenspan at that point had developed such a reputation. He was our economic laureate, and so... whatever he endorsed carried great weight. I mean, you notice when he goes before Congress, the congressmen and senators ask him about everything except monetary policy.
Really?
I'm surprised they haven't asked him about same-sex marriages so far, because he is an expert. He's a true Renaissance man. He also gets, I think, some power in appointing or recommending his colleagues.
Yeah.
And that way he can maybe not have any major critics.
Peter, where the hell does he come from? Where does this, before he could walk on water, what's his background?
Well, he had a very interesting flirtation with Ayn Rand and her clique in the late 50s and early 60s.
Like our erstwhile Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser.
That's right. He was never really part of the inner circle, but it at least got him on the record supporting the gold standard as the only way to run a monetary system, which is pretty interesting, because then he then went on to run a monetary system, as Paul said, based on nothing but thin air, which is the way all current monetary systems run. After that, he started his own consulting firm, a very small firm on Wall Street, where he was essentially an economic forecaster. Interestingly, his record of forecasting wasn't so hot, but that didn't stop him getting an important job in government. He moved into the Republican milieu and got a succession of jobs in Republican White Houses until finally this ultimate job in the economic system as chairman of the Fed.
Is he physically formidable? Does he look... I mean, he seems to me to look the part. And this is a society, a culture, where looking the part is probably about 85% of the job. It certainly seems to apply to presidents.
Well, he certainly carries gravitas, and that sort of hangdog look, which is interpreted to conceal, you know, a very serious, great mind. Yes, he does all of that. But you know what he does that's not visible? You were asking Paul about what instruments of coercion or persuasion does he have. Well, apart from the obvious one that he controls interest rates, he's also the master cultivator of other powerful people in Washington. There's a statistic and an anecdote. The statistic is a researcher at the Wharton School got hold of his personal diaries through the Freedom of Information Act.
His personal diaries?
Yes.
Through FOI?
That's right.
Dear.
Or should I say his office appointment diary?
Oh, right.
Yes, not his personal. Correction. But got hold of his appointments diary and learned from that Greenspan in 96, which was Clinton era, was holding... an average of 2 formal scheduled meetings with politicians a week. 6 years later, in the Bush era, he was holding an average of 4 scheduled meetings with politicians a week, including 1 a week on average with the White House. Wow. Now, as the researcher who dug up the numbers remarked, this makes him not aloof from politics, but one of the most political people in Washington.
Paul, when he steps down, will you be offering him a job at the Northern Trust in Chicago?
Well, I don't have much say in that, but But given his forecasting record, I would not recommend it.
Yeah.
I think he, you know, has not had a stellar career in forecasting very many things.
When you and Keith Schapp were writing Seven Indicators That Move the Markets, was he one of the indicators?
Well, he creates money, so you know, money talks. So, at least indirectly, he certainly was. Yes.
Now, what the sort of the networking, if something as lofty as what he does can be thus described, that Peter's been talking about, is that is pretty well known in town, is it, Paul?
Oh yes. I mean, you know, it's well documented, and he seems to enjoy that. I think that's probably going to be the real downside of him leaving for him, is that he probably won't be as sought after at cocktail parties as he is.
I want to get low down and dirty now, Peter. Let's forget the economics. He's Greenspan's friends say of him, and you say of him, that he's got a good sense of humour, despite the lugubrious facial expression. And others would point out, as I do, that he seems to have forgotten how to smile. But he's always attracted very beautiful women, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. It's a bit of a mystery, isn't it? People, women,
what did Kissinger saying about power being a great aphrodisiac?
Yes, he said it was the ultimate aphrodisiac. Mm. That's right. And I'm sure there's an element of that. Women who've been with him over the years say that he's very charming, very intelligent, very sensitive, and that makes him very sexy. I don't know. You shouldn't really ask me. You need something more than an economist.
I'm not going to ask Paul whether he finds him sexy. I don't think he'd comment on that. Yeah,
but he is very charming, and he's very he's almost his personal manner is almost courtly. He's very attentive, very a very good listener. You know, I think these. Plus, he's got a few million in the bank. This probably helps to qualify him as a catch.
Mm. Now, Paul, no one's listening to this program. Anything you say is simply between the three of us. What are your predictions as to what will happen once the American housing bubble bursts?
Well, I think that we're going to have the serious and deep recession that we probably should have had after the NASDAQ bubble.
Oh, look, that's enough of that. I want to send people off to sleep happy. But look, thank you very much, gentlemen. Peter Hartcher, international political editor for the Sydney Morning Herald. The book that I'm holding in my hand up to the microphone is Bubble Man, Alan Greenspan and the Missing $7 Trillion. That's quite a black hole. And Paul Kasriel, who's the Senior Vice President and Chief Economist at Northern Trust in Chicago. And his book is Seven Indicators That Move Markets, and that's published by McGraw-Hill. And Peter's book, incidentally, is published by Black Ink, who are a terrific little mob in Australia.